Good morning. This is Carol Spindell sitting in today for David Inge, and we're talking with one of the authors of a new book about college admissions. Today's high school students applying to college face a daunting process, a new SAT, fewer dollars in financial aid, probable rejection, and lots of myths about how to choose a college and how to get in. So how can you help your student gather accurate information and make the best choices for him or her? We're joined today by Sally Springer. She's the Associate Chancellor at the University of California, Davis. She's also the co-author with Marion Frank of a new book called Admission Matters, What Students and Parents Need to Know About Getting into College. Hello, Sally, and welcome to Focus 580.
Good morning, Carol. Thank you very much.
Now, I understand that you are joining us from Tampa, where you're at the National Association for College Admissions Counselors?
Yes, that's correct.
Great. Well, then college admissions is the subject today here in Urbana and in Tampa. I'd like to mention to our listeners that if you have questions about college admissions, please join this conversation by calling toll-free 1-800-222-9455 or locally 333-9455, and we'll be glad to take your calls. Now, maybe I'm rosy about the past, but it seems to me that students used to pick one or two schools, often close to home, take one test, write one essay, send the whole thing off. And unless they had completely overestimated their chances, they often got back those big letters. And now it's very competitive, especially at selective private schools. It's also increasingly competitive at public universities in states like California and Illinois. And Sally, what are the forces that have changed this process so much?
Well, there are several factors. One of the factors is demographic. If you take a look at population trends, there's been an increase in the number of high school graduates, starting in perhaps, I guess, maybe mid-1990s. And right now, we're at a little less than 3 million graduates each year. And it's going to be going up, reaching a peak of almost 3.2 million in 2009. And it's going to stay pretty high for at least another 10 years after that, although it won't be increasing at that rate. But that's just part of the picture. There are more students wanting to go, potentially who can go to college. More of them want to go to college because the message has gotten out that a college education is important for careers. So that's an additional factor. A larger percentage of students are interested in going to college. It's also easier to apply to college these days. If you have recent familiarity with the process, the old days of correction fluid and typewriters and so forth have gone the way of a dinosaur, and there are online applications that make it very easy for students to apply to lots of colleges. Colleges also are very active in spreading the word about their offerings. And you have small liberal arts colleges that have an incoming class of maybe 500 students sending out upwards of 50,000 mailers to prospective students. And so colleges are eager to build a strong, diverse applicant pool. So you have all of those factors entering into the equation. More students applying to more colleges because it's easier. But the major factor, and I wish I had actually come up with this quote myself, but it's something that a very wise high school counselor indicated. The reason it's hard for students to get into college is that they all want to get into colleges that are hard to get into. And that means that there are a disproportionate number of students focusing on a very small group of colleges.
Well, you say in the book that all this stress and all this competition that we hear about is really most of the time about the same 100 schools, and that all these competitive top students apply to the same schools, and that other schools even have vacancies in their freshman classes. So why do you think it is that students and parents don't look beyond these schools?
Well, let me just modify a little bit, though, the first sentence. It's true in our book we talk about a top 100. Actually, that number's grown a bit. We're probably looking at now maybe 125 or maybe even 150 schools. The reason I think parents and students focus on those schools are those are the ones they know about. The colleges that have big football teams people know about because the names are always in the media. People know about the Ivy League. They know about the colleges that are nearby. But the fact is, there are over 2,000 colleges and universities, four-year colleges and universities in this country. And the typical family knows just a very small percentage of those. And those are the ones that the students tend to focus on.
So one of the first things for families is to figure out ways to find out about schools beyond that list that may be appropriate for their student.
Right. I absolutely. And the question is, well, what is appropriate for a given student? And I think the whole process has to begin with a self-assessment on the part of the student. The student needs to ask himself or herself some questions and to answer them as honestly as possible. What kind of student am I? What kind of environment, academic environment, do I thrive in? What are my academic interests? What kind of social cultural environment am I seeking? What kind of geographic environment? What kind of weather do I like? What kind can I tolerate? And so forth. And so there are a whole range of factors that I think need to be carefully considered. And then the student and family can go about looking for good matches.
Well, we hear a lot about rankings of schools, and U.S. News and World Report puts out rankings every year in the early fall. And everyone seems to agree that these rankings are deeply flawed, and yet they still get a lot of attention. How do you explain that?
Yes, rankings. Well, I think one reason that they get so much attention is that they're easy. And U.S. News has a lot of money behind them, a lot of publicity behind them, and they get their magazines everywhere. I walked into my local bookstore the other day, and there must have been 100 copies of that U.S. News rankings issue prominently featured, so you can't miss it. It's easy. Learning about colleges takes some time. If you want to learn about the various features of the college and how they would match up with your students' particular needs and interests, it's easy to pick up a magazine and see which colleges are ranked the highest. And I personally don't think it's a very good way to attempt to make that kind of match. I don't think there's anyone in higher education who believes that you can distill the essence of a college into a single number and that you can then rank colleges in terms of that ranking and have it mean anything.
Now, in the book, you mention a survey program run by Indiana University that asks quite different questions in order to kind of evaluate the educational experience that students get at a given university or college. And could you tell us about that? And do you think that's a better system?
Well, this is a survey called the National Survey for Student Engagement, or NESE. And I do think it's a much better way to get a handle on the quality of education at an institution and student satisfaction. And it asks questions of students such as, how often did you have to write papers in your classes? What were the opportunities for discussion, both inside and outside of the classroom? What opportunities were there for meaningful internships? And that kind of survey gets at much more so at the heart of an institution's quality and approach to education. And unfortunately, there are some colleges many colleges actually, that don't use NESE, and some that actually do don't make their results public. So those institutions that do make their results public have them on the web, and they can be a very useful source of information for prospective students.
So if prospective students wanted to access that data, how would they do it?
Well, I'm actually right now looking through my copy of Admission Matters, looking for the URL. Actually, I think you could simply type in National Survey of student engagement into a browser and come up with it, but I'm actually
While you look for it, let me repeat the phone numbers in case there are listeners who would like to call and ask a question if you have a prospective student. 1-800-222-9455 or 333-9455. Or if you have a general question about this issue of college admissions, you're welcome to call in.
I found it, Carol.
Okay.
You can find out more about NESE and the colleges that have chosen to participate by going to www.indiana.edu/, and then this little squiggle, little tilde, NSSE for National Survey for Student Engagement, and then / again. And that'll take you to their website.
Great. And, you know, we can put that on our website if listeners didn't get that down. We can put that on the WILL website later today. Now, let's go to the topic of financial aid. This has become a confusing and complicated maze. But maybe before we do that, we have a caller from Urbana. So let's let them join the conversation. Nope. Hello? Are you there in Urbana?
Yes, I am.
Line number one? All right. Go ahead.
I had a question about trends among students who are going to college. You talked about the increase in numbers, but I'd like to know about the fields that they're going into. Back in the old days, people said, well, just get a basic liberal arts education, get a little taste of everything, then pick a major. But I'm wondering if more students are going in the front door, specializing in things like more technical kinds of courses, film studies or something else. I mean, have you noticed any trends along those lines as to what students are studying?
Well, I think there is a trend towards education that is more focused towards a career. Engineering programs are very popular, computer science. Other kinds of business programs as an undergraduate are very, very popular. And, in fact, I think that may be one of the reasons why there is a trend over time for greater popularity of universities. Now, this gets us into a little bit of terminology, and I just need to say just a little bit about it. Some institutions are called colleges, some are called universities, and institutions can choose which one they want to call themselves. But the definition of a university is an institution with a very wide range of programs, including doctoral education. And so at universities, you'll tend to find a much broader array of programs, including the professionally oriented programs, as opposed to liberal arts colleges that, by and large, don't have any of those professional programs. And I think that's part of the reason why you see some of the enrollment trends that you do, greater enrollments at the universities, greater increases with proportional decreases at the liberal arts colleges.
Mm-hmm. So that sort of guarantees a job quicker.
Well, I don't know if it guarantees a job quicker. I mean, there are folks. It depends if you're thinking about going on for graduate work or not.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if a student is thinking about going on for an MBA, Master's in Business Administration, you don't have to major in business as an undergraduate. In fact, business schools look very favorably at students who come in with other kinds of majors because they will give you what you need in that Master's Business Administration. If you're thinking about being an engineer, on the other hand, whether or not you want to go on for graduate work, you probably do need that bachelor's degree in engineering. But I'm one of the maybe old-fashioned folks who believe that a good liberal arts education, a good founding in the basic disciplines is the best preparation of all for life and for most careers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks very much to our caller. Hello? Sally?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good. Okay. Well, let's talk about financial aid.
Okay, Do you have any specific question on that?
Well, it seems like a confusing and complicated maze. Some schools are need aware, others are need blind. Some say right out front, we give no merit aid. Others do use merit aid to recruit the students they want. And then you hear about many families who are sitting there at graduation facing huge debts that have to be repaid. I mean, where should a family start to make sense of this when they're planning for their children's education?
Well, I think a very good place to start, and in part it depends on where you are in the process. If you're the parent of a junior in high, or sophomore or junior, or perhaps a senior in high school, and you want to get a good sense of your family's eligibility for need-based financial aid, a good way to do that is with one of the online programs that allows you to determine what would be your expected family contribution. Institutions take the following approach in looking at financial aid. There's the cost of education, how much it's going to cost to send the student to college, and that's tuition, room and board, books, and so forth. And that's the cost of education. Then there's something called the expected family contribution. And that is, how much can the family be expected to contribute to the student's education? And the difference between those two, the cost and how much the family can be expected to contribute, the difference between those two is the financial need of the family. And clearly, if you have a more expensive school, given that the family contribution is fixed, the financial need will be greater. What a family needs to determine is what their expected family contribution will be. And there are two ways of doing that. Everyone has to complete something called the FAFSA if you're applying for financial aid. It's called the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. And there are some websites that allow you to sort of preview what the result of the FAFSA will be by putting in information about family income and savings and so forth. So the FAFSA is used by virtually all institutions that award federal financial aid. But it gets a little more complicated than that. There's something called the profile, which is another tool that allows institutions to determine how much a family can contribute. But this one includes things like home equity, whereas the FAFSA doesn't. And so home equity, given the run-up in housing prices across the country, makes families look a little more better off than they might otherwise be. And so those two methods of needs assessment are the main ones, and families can preview those to get a feel for what colleges might expect them to contribute to their students' education. We talk about expected family contribution. It is defined by formula. Colleges do have a bit of wiggle room, but what a family can contribute is not determined by the family in terms of how much they're willing to contribute. The family might feel they can't contribute as much as the needs assessment says they can. But the needs assessment results are, you know, what they are. So I think it's important for families to get a handle on that, because there can be some surprises. Sometimes family might think, oh, gosh, we wouldn't be eligible for any need-based aid, when in fact they are. Or you sometimes get surprises the other way. A family might think that they are eligible, but then the needs assessment comes out showing that they're not.
Well, when I said I was going to interview you, one parent said to me that her family scrimped and saved, and they gave up vacations to save money for their daughter's college tuition. Then when the time came to calculate the FAFSA, the need-based financial aid, those savings counted against them, and their daughter received almost nothing. And another family that this family was aware of spent all their money on travel and saved nothing. And The first parent said that in retrospect, she should have spent the money because she felt she lost out twice. She didn't get the experience of the travel, and her family didn't get the vacations, and she didn't get a very good financial aid package for her daughter. Do you think middle-class families are getting squeezed out of financial aid?
Well, middle-class family, that is where the real problem in financial aid lies. But I'd like to address, though, the issue of saving and so forth. Parental savings, and here's where it is a good idea, at least given the current laws with regard to federal financial aid. It is best for parents to save for college in their own name rather than in the student's name, because that is assessed at a much lower rate when it comes to assessing financial need. Having money saved in the parent's name as opposed to the student is even if it's all planned to support college later on, is the best way to go. The reality is, though, that you just never know what's going to happen down the line in terms of financial aid and the form in which a need-based financial aid might be awarded. Depending on the college and the student's circumstances, financial aid packages can include a large percentage of the award in the form of loans that have to be repaid. True, they're low-interest loans, but they do have to be repaid. And the family that has saved won't have to go the loan route. But yes, to answer your initial question, it is the middle class that faces the greatest challenge when it comes to financial aid, because clearly folks who can afford to pay full freight don't have to worry about financial aid, and institutions are most generous with those at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum who can't contribute very much.
Do you think that low-income families may be very hesitant to encourage their children to apply to expensive private schools? And I wonder if some of those low-income families may be perhaps missing opportunities that actually are out there at these need-blind and need-aware schools because of lack of adequate guidance counseling.
Oh, absolutely. And I think colleges are increasingly aware of the fact that students from lower socioeconomic groups are not applying because of the concerns that they won't be able to afford an expensive institution. But if you refer back to what I mentioned earlier about the way financial need is calculated, you look at the expected family contribution, and then you have the total cost of education, with financial need being the difference between the two. If institution is more expensive, well, that means the financial need is going to be bigger. And at many institutions, it means a bigger financial aid package. And in fact, some very high-profile institutions, I'm thinking now Yale and Harvard and Princeton, Yale and Harvard more recently, have basically said that for low-income families, for students who are admitted, the families won't have to contribute anything. And some of those schools aren't even including loans in the packages. And so they are hard at work trying to get the word out that financial aid should not be, or the need for financial aid should not be a barrier at these institutions that meet full need.
And despite that reality, there is probably a very big difference between the guidance counseling that students receive, even if we look at just public high schools, and we don't even look at private schools, but look at public high schools in a city neighborhood, perhaps, or in a rural area, and in a wealthy suburb.
Yes, no, that's very true. When you look at counselor-to-student ratio or student-to-counselor ratios, there are public high schools in this country with almost 1,000 students per single counselor. At my high school, there's something like 600 students to a counselor, and these are all-purpose counselors, not just focusing on college. They're dealing with a whole spectrum of student counseling issues, and so there can be big disparities. Schools that are well-funded have much richer ratios. That's one of the reasons why, or actually it's probably the main reason why Marion Frank and I wrote admission matters. We wanted to try to level the playing field so that families would be able to access the kind of information that they might not be able to get from their counselors, or they can better utilize the time that they have with their counselors, because they'll come into the situation with the counselor informed and then can focus on their specific needs in that personal situation.
I know that our local public high school, I was told by the principal that it's very hard to recruit and retain guidance counselors. I don't know if that's a factor of our local salaries, or I know there's a lot of increased paperwork that guidance counselors face now. But it seems to me that if we do want to level the playing field of college admissions, and college and universities are doing their part by offering these kind of programs, don't somehow all students need the same access to college counseling? Is there anything we could do about that, do you think?
Well, I think that schools tend to be locally funded, and I think parents need to be advocates for their children, and to make the case for funding going into counseling programs. They are very important for student success, not only college admissions, but in dealing with a whole host of other issues associated with the high school years. It is a serious problem.
Well, and then on the other hand, of course, I think a lot of parents think that if their children don't get into the Ivy League, their future is ended. But your book points out that the data does not correlate future salaries or admission to selective graduate schools with having gone to these very selective colleges.
That's correct. If you just look at the data on the surface, and you do comparisons of salary, perhaps 10 or 20 years post-graduation, you do find that the graduates of, say, the Ivy League have a higher annual income than graduates of lesser, less well-known institutions. If you look overall at graduate school admissions, you find a disproportionate number of Ivy League graduates in prestigious programs. But the question is, why? And some researchers, Dale and Kruger, Stacy Dale and Alan Kruger, said, well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that the students who go to the Ivy League are pre-selected in some fashion, and that it's those factors that the students bring with them to the Ivy League that are the determinants of the salary later in life or admission to prestigious graduate programs. And so they did something that I thought was very clever. They looked at students and who were admitted, who applied to and who were admitted to Ivy League colleges, and they divided them up into two groups, those that actually went to an Ivy League college, and then they also tracked those students who, for whatever reason, were admitted to an Ivy League school, but chose to go to a less selective school. And then they compared those two groups. And as you can see, what that does is it controls for the input factors. And what you find when you do that is that there are no differences between the two groups, except in the case of students from low socioeconomic backgrounds. In that case, there is a bump associated with going to the more selective institution. But for everyone else, there is no difference. And so those are two, very crude indices of life success, your salary 20 years down the line or your admission to a graduate program, and no difference.
Really, of course, all of us educators hope there's more to education than that, that somehow can't be measured.
Absolutely. I'd like to tell folks that success in life, no matter how you choose to define it, has absolutely nothing to do with the bumper sticker or, on the back of the car. What does success in life have to do with? I think what are the factors that lead to success? I think one is, how bright you are, how smart you are, and this is an order of increasing importance now, how hard you're willing to work, how motivated you are, and then lastly and most importantly, your ability to establish and maintain lasting, meaningful relationships with other people. And those things have absolutely nothing to do with what college you go to as an undergraduate.
Okay, well, we have a caller here on line four on a cell phone. Welcome to the conversation.
Hello. I wanted her to speak to the fact that at a university, not all students are above average or, you know, carry a 4.0 grade average. Speak to the student that is an average student and are trying to get into, you know, like my daughter's trying to get into a pharmacy school, but her grade, you know, she's not a 4.0 student. She's an average student. How does she maximize her ability to get into a pharmacy school?
Well, she's currently an undergraduate, and she wants to go into a graduate program?
Yes. No, she wants to transfer after a two-year at a community college.
Okay, so she's currently in a community college, and she wants to transfer? Okay, well, I think for transferring into programs, especially from a community college, they are going to be looking for success in courses that the student would have taken and originally gone into that particular program. So that they will be looking at the academic record. They probably have some kind of testing requirement, so preparing for those would be good. Also, if your daughter's had an opportunity to get to know some faculty at the community college, those kinds of recommendations can be very, very helpful, especially if her academic record itself isn't that strong for whatever reason. If a teacher can attest to her work ethic, her motivation, her interest in pursuing the field, that can be an important factor in the admissions process.
Okay, well, thanks very much to our caller from the cell phone, and we have another caller from Kankakee. Hello, are you there? Line number one?
The caller wonders if the most significant question with reference to embarking in higher education is not simply the city in which it is to be pursued. If one concerns themselves with admissions and with finances, doesn't one overlook the main point? Some of the greatest centers of higher education are well known. Wouldn't it be better for scholars to go to those cities and to be educated as they can? Thank you.
Well, I think one of the beauties about higher education in America is that it is so diverse, and that we have so many wonderful institutions, and that we're not necessarily just concentrated in a few places. I mean, we have excellence in many, many places in this country. I actually think it's one of the great features of our country.
Well, you know, we hear a lot of talk these days about the new SAT and how that includes a writing component. What effect do you think that will have on admissions?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell, Carol. The jury's still out on that because this is the first year. The class of 2006 is the first class to take the new SAT, and colleges are still trying to figure out what to do with it. I mean, the University of California, which was actually in the 10 campuses of the University of California, that indirectly was behind the creation of the new SAT, has decided to incorporate it into the admissions process. Some other colleges, or most other colleges, are taking the approach of, well, let's just see. This is something new. We don't know how well it's going to predict performance in college. I think you'll find a number of colleges sort of looking at it, but not quite being sure what to do with it yet.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait and see. We have another caller. Line four on a cell phone. Hello? Hello? Are you there on line four? No? Okay. I guess not. Well, you can call back. Didn't the creators of the SAT originally think that they were creating a test that would test ability rather than education and therefore increase the chances of students who hadn't gone to the best high schools, who weren't the children of Yale alums and so on? But then they also thought that the test wasn't teachable or coachable, which has been proven wrong. So, I mean, this history of standardized testing seems to be a history of good intentions.
You're right. It is a history of good intentions that I guess some folks now feel are not really intentions just aren't good enough, that the results are not what was intended. You're absolutely right. Originally, the SAT was thought of as a way to get beyond the students' particular educational circumstances so that kids who had access to first-rate schools would do very well on the Latin and other kinds of tests that were part of the admissions process, but that the SAT would get at sort of, in some sense, ability and enable you to find students who didn't have access to those rich educational opportunities. Now, though, folks are concerned that that the SAT is standing in the way of talented students getting access to higher education opportunities, because the test has been shown to be highly coachable. And the new SAT is even more coachable than ever, and one can argue, well, you've modified the test so that it allows students to prepare for it, and so you're sort of potentially leveling the playing field in that way. But if you have differential availability of access to those tools to prepare, then you've got problems as well. Then you're introducing new kinds of inequities.
Let me remind again, if you're listening and would like to call and ask a question of Sally Springer, the author of a new book called Admission Matters, What Students and Parents Need to Know About Getting into College. Our number here, toll-free, is 1-800-222-9455 or 333-9455. I'm Carol Spindell, sitting in for David Inge today. So, Sally, are there other factors in the student's high school record that do correlate better than high test scores with good academic performance in college? Is it possible to predict who will do well in college?
Well, probably the best predictor of how well a student is going to do in college is how well they did in high school. Their grades in a demanding curriculum. Because if you think about it, what is a student doing in college? They're taking college-level courses, and if you've demonstrated the ability to do that well in high school, the chances are you'll continue to do that in college. But, of course, we all know that motivation is an important factor in all of this, and some students, for whatever reason, just don't, to use an expression, don't quite get their act together until they're a little more mature. And so you can have students who perhaps don't do particularly well in high school, perhaps taking some time off or going to a community college, ending up doing spectacularly later on. But right now, if you had to pick a single best predictor, it would be how well the student did as a high school student in the most demanding courses available to him or her. But it's certainly not a perfect predictor, and the SAT certainly isn't a perfect predictor either.
Your co-author, Marian Frank, confesses in one of the personal accounts in your book that one of the hardest things she ever had to do in life was to step back and not want to sort of shine personally by seeing her children apply to and possibly get admitted to prestigious schools. And that's a very seductive process, and I think here in a university town we see a lot of it, this temptation to push your children. And you find out that you do get quite a bit of reflective glory if they are successful. So how can parents navigate that very difficult process of being supportive without pushing?
Well, I think they have to realize, let me tell you, step back for a moment, tell you a little anecdote. My son was accepted at a very selective college, and I was happy and proud that he was, and people would ask me where he was going to school, and I would tell them, and I very quickly became embarrassed because of the gushing responses that I received when I told him where he was going to school, and I thought to myself, you know, he's just been admitted to college. He hasn't won the Nobel Prize. I mean, things have really gotten sort of warped, and I think it's important for parents and students to focus on fit, to look at those colleges that will best meet the students' needs, and to realize that those schools come in a wide range of selectivities, and that a highly selective institution isn't necessarily the best match. And it's, I think once people focus on fit, prestige gets moved to the back burner, and I strongly encourage families, parents, and students to stop talking about college as much as they do in terms of, oh, well, where is Johnny applying, and where did Susie get an ED, and so forth. That tends to feed the frenzy, and focusing on fit, learning as much as you can about a wide range of colleges is the best way for there to be a very happy outcome. I know of one young woman who went to a highly selective college. She wanted to go to the most selective college she could get into. She went to one. It turned out to be a terrible fit. She was miserable for the 3.5 years she was there, but wouldn't consider transferring because she wanted that sticker on the back of her car. I say 3.5 years because she graduated early because she didn't want to go back for that last 6 months. And I think she will reflect back and realize what a loss of a wonderful experience that was.
You wonder, when you do read about admissions for these selective schools, and students have to be so good at so many things to get into these schools. I was visited by a French educator who spent quite a bit of time in American schools, and that's what she said to me. She said, you know, French students work very hard, but she says what really strikes me about American students is they're expected to be so good at so many things. And do you think there's too much pressure on these kids who are very capable now?
Well, I do. I think the whole college admissions process has created a level of anxiety and frenzy that is harmful. In fact, after our telephone call, I'm going to be going back to the NACAC meeting, the National Association for College Admissions Counseling, and going to a session on mental health issues associated with the college admissions process. The idea that all of the stress that we're are inadvertently placing on students has its cost. And I think if a student and family steps back and realizes there are a range of colleges out there that offer wonderful opportunities, that would be a terrific fit, that takes a lot of the pressure off. Again, you know, we're talking about somewhere between 100 and 150 colleges that accept less than 50% of the students that apply, and we're the other 2,000 four-year institutions in the country accept at least half of their students, and many accept, you know, 80% or more. And so it's that focus on that very narrow group that's contributing to the stress, anxiety, and so forth.
Well, so the ideal would be to have a student find a number of places where they feel that meet their criteria, they can have a successful education, they can probably get accepted. But, you know, it often seems like it doesn't work that way. You meet a lot of juniors, even seniors, who are saying, I just don't know. How will I know this is the right college for me? How can students know?
Well, I think, again, it goes back to doing that careful self-assessment, and then to learning as much as possible about colleges that seem to be a good match. Again, you know, there are over 2,000 of them, so you can't start going through all of them. But you do this initial process. There are online college search tools where you put in your criteria and outcome some colleges that at least the computer program thinks would be a good match. Mm-hmm. It's a good place to start. You can then do some careful research, learning about those colleges, and also, if you have the opportunity, going to visit them. That can be a wonderful way to see firsthand whether there's a potentially good match there. But that's just part of it. You have to do the basic research, reading the college catalog, the web, participating in perhaps online chat rooms with current students at that institution.
Okay, well, we're going to go to line one. We have a caller from Charleston. Hello, line one from Charleston. Are you there?
Yes, good morning. With the advantage of 2020 hindsight, I can say that the experience that we've had in our family, our daughter graduated from high school in about 1990 or 91, as I recall. Bright kid, got good SAT scores and so forth. She applied to a number of schools and was accepted to Miami of Ohio, which is, I understand, a pretty good liberal arts school. And she majored in one of the natural sciences, but frankly, I don't think she was mature or ready to handle all that, because she ended up getting her degree, as we say, in geology with a minor in bartending. And that grade point average suffered as a result. So when she went out into the job market, she was unable to get a job in her field. So she worked in an administrative job for a couple of years. Subsequently, decided to go back to get a degree in civil engineering from Georgia Tech, which she ended up paying for. And is now 30 years old, married, and has a very successful career with an engineering consulting firm. So I think if we had to do it over again, rather than pushing her out to be the best that you can be, I think a trial run at a good quality junior college for 2 years might have been a good idea in hindsight. And I'd like to hear your with the option to transfer to whatever school she can get in. I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Sure. No, again, it varies so much from student to student, but the community college route can be an excellent one. It gives the student the opportunity to mature, and then there's the opportunity to transfer to a four-year institution. So, again, it really comes down to the individual student, but the community college route is a fine one. And I tell the story, I'll tell it really quickly. I was on the faculty for many years, the psychology department at SUNY Stony Brook, a colleague of mine who turned out to have a spectacularly successful career, who went from Stony Brook as a professor to Princeton. She's now a professor at Yale in the psychology department, which is one of the best psychology departments in the world. She began her career as an undergraduate at a community college. I think it's a wonderful option, depending on the circumstances.
Okay, thanks.
Welcome.
Well, thanks very much for the call. We just have a few more minutes. So you've been through this college admissions process at least once, isn't that right?
I have. My son is now a junior, but I'm going through it right now. My daughter is a high school senior.
Aha. So you're getting to see how it's changed in a couple of years.
I am. It is more competitive now, even a couple of years, for that group of 100 to 150 colleges.
So being someone who's personally experienced this, who is involved with admissions at UC Davis, you come at this from a number of perspectives. You are involved in counseling. What one piece of advice, if parents and students just take away one thing, what would you like to say to them?
Well, I think I tell parents and students to focus on what they can control about the admissions process, and not on what they can't control. And what they can control is the self-assessment process and the research into identifying that list of good fit colleges. If you identify a set of good fit colleges over a range of selectivities, you're virtually guaranteed a happy outcome. And that's what I think everyone hopes for when they start the college admissions process. So it all comes down to selecting that right group of colleges.
Well, that is definitely what we want. And I think, too, we are all concerned about a level playing field and want to see students who get to a place and who can be successful there, who can have a good experience, too. So perhaps that right fit will lead to a positive outcome. 4 years later, these students are graduating, and they want to look back and feel that they did make a good choice.
Absolutely.
So did your advice work when your own child applied to college, or have you modified your your program since
you... I actually learned, even though I've been in higher education for more years than I care to count, I learned a lot about institutions that I hadn't really known much about. And so I think in working with my daughter, my major contribution to her college application process has been to make her aware of some colleges that really weren't particularly on my radar screen when my son was applying. So, and I'm also trying to, walk the talk in terms of giving her, you know, lots of space and not adding my own level of anxiety to the process.
Well, that sounds like a very worthy goal. We just appreciate so much you being with us this morning, Sally. We've been speaking with Sally Springer. She's the Associate Chancellor at the University of California, Davis. She is also, along with Marion Frank, the co-author of a new book called Admission Matters, What Students and Parents Need to Know About Getting into College. Thank you so much for being with us today on Focus 580.
Thank you, Carol. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. Henry Frayne was our technical director today. Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal produced our program. Thanks to all of them. I'm Carol Spindell. I'm sitting in for David Inge today on Focus 580.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
And now we'll go to Dave Dickey, who has today's numbers.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. We start today with the outside markets, where we have news from the New York Mercantile Exchange, which declared a force majeure on remaining September natural gas deliveries due to the closure of the Sabine Pipeline, which operates a key Henry Hub delivery port in Louisiana. In August, the Henry Hub shut down also during the onslaught of Hurricane Katrina and reopened a day later after the facility avoided significant damage. So it's the second straight month that we're seeing a force majeure. After the August contract deliveries were force majeured last month, now September force majeure today. Isn't having that much of an impact at the moment, though, on the October natural gas contract. It's trading at $12.53, down 26 cents on the day. Over on the Chicago Board of Trade, we're seeing some interesting locksteps. Wheat had led the corn higher for the last several sessions, but wheat down today, and that is in pulling the other commodities down as well, although at the moment we're seeing on the live tick wheat trying to make a little bit of a comeback, a little bit of a rally. Let's go ahead and look at the current numbers for you. December wheat at 333.5, up 1.25. March 3.